And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025 for the final stream tonight. I'm now here with JF Gariepi. Hope I've pronounced that correctly. JF has been on quite a few times before. I think this might be the 7th or 8th time. So welcome back to the show. And we will obviously talk about events of this year. But first, we're going to talk about your new book that you're writing just now. So please introduce us to that.
Absolutely. I'm writing a book called White People Food. Very happy to be here tonight. Thanks for having me, Millennial. It's quite a tradition. Oh, do I have a sound issue? I'm a little low, maybe?
I think are you sure that it's the correct microphone that's selected?
I don't know why it went low suddenly. I heard a clap in my audio setup. All right. Hello. That is maybe a little too high. How about now?
Yes, that sounds good.
Okay. So yeah, I'm writing a book called White People Food because I realized just how important food is to survival of people and to provide a standard also, because I see foods disappearing from places. And I see people complaining about that in France, in Canada. There's just foods that used to exist and they don't exist anymore. So I thought, let's have a book that's a standard that says this existed at this point in time. In 2025, you could know about a meat pie. In 2025, you could know about the Cullen's kink and you could know about haggis. And let's see in 30 years from now if that still exists. And I wanted to ask people, everyone on the chat, give me your food that's important to you. Because as a Canadian, I can only know French culture, English culture. If you're from any European country, any white group of people, tell me what your food, the food that you hold dear in your heart. And I would like to know from you, Millennial Woes, are there foods that evoke some warmth more than others?
Oh, well, I would think about things that I had from childhood, and that'd be various soups, potato soup, lentil soup, and baked potatoes. They've always featured heavily in my life. Jacket potatoes.
So yeah. What would be in the baked potatoes for a Scotman?
Oh, well, butter, baked beans, sweet corn. Lots of different things because it differs from one person to the next. Yeah, but that's what I would have in it. It's a very versatile food and very healthy for you as well.
People are mentioning toad in the hole. I already have it in the book.
Right. So how far are you into the book? Are you still at the planning or have you written most of it?
I have 160 pages written. My target is 300, and I've captured a lot of the American culture breakfast sandwich, full English breakfast, which I call full white breakfast. I have the sauces, the art of the sauces, the bread. I have the burger buns, the baguette bread. I'm pretty extensively advanced, and my goal is that it's available before next Christmas.
Right. Well, that's plenty of time. But of course, when you're working on a big project like that, a year actually isn't that long. So, yeah, time flies.
Yes, absolutely. I love the Millennial today. I've been listening to Jeff Deist. I really love what he had to say about libertarianism. I essentially agree with him, but I still identify as a libertarian. I think that if you approach libertarianism pragmatically as a kind of just a standard, You can accept that it's just a pragmatic basis for when is it that we don't step over other people's toes and let's go from there. Let's start from there as a basis. But then let's understand also that individualizing everything has its consequences and it basically negates our biology.
Yeah, that's true. It's not just that it leads to bad social consequences. It also is anti-human in that sense that it's negating our biology. There are dysgenic consequences, dysgenic genetic consequences, but also just miserable. Jeff and I went into that in quite a lot of depth. So yeah, I mean, I like freedom, liberty as much as the next guy, and I've always valued it. Certainly, my own personal liberty. I don't like being constrained or whatever. So I understand this. I understand the desire for it. I just think that no man is an island, and we all exist in a social context, and a nation, and a tribe, and a town, all of that. And these things are just as important as the individual's right to liberty.
Absolutely.
All right. So is there anything else that you'd like to tell people about the book? It's going to be out hopefully by next Christmas. So it'll be a nice Christmas present for people.
Absolutely. It will be called White People Food. And yes, I'm noting everything you guys are saying on the Rumble chat. Pork pie with jelly. Wonderful. And scotch broth. I already had it. So yes, thank you for giving me all of your favorites. And feel free to send me emails because I want to be all encompassing. And I want to capture the different cultures of white people because it goes from Russia, from soups that I have never heard about, up to the soups of my childhood.
And another one, you could actually start the book with a map and a page number for each place on the map. Another one from Scotland would be Stovies. That's Stovies. Another one.
Never heard this one. What is it?
I don't exactly know, but I used to have it a lot as a child. It's Stovies. Okay. You should look that one up. I honestly wish I could tell you what it was, but I don't actually know. Okay, well, that sounds interesting. So good luck with that. And now we're going to get to political events of the year, and at least in the American context. Ah, yes, something like that, yeah. Indeed. In the American context, I think apart from the inauguration of Trump, the other massive political event this year was the killing of Charlie Kirk. Why don't you take that away, and I'll intervene here and there.
Yeah, it's very important what's been happening. And there is, unfortunately, despite the drama that it is and the terrible even that it is to lose a human being, it's almost like it refreshes the political landscape toward a positive direction. And of course, I was personally emotionally shocked when learning about the death of Charlie Kirk, but it's fascinating what it leads to, because it has regularized Nick Fuentes. It has led the current Republican Party to realize perhaps the gravity of the situation, and it has led them to, at least in words, be opened to white positive language. We had just, while the millennial was being filmed today, we had J.D. Vance come out and say, I will quote him precisely, in the United States of America, you don't have to apologize for being white anymore. Now, this is not something I would have expected of him a year ago. Something has changed in the politics, and despite the fact that it seems like white positive talk, he follows this sentence with, you don't have to apologize for being Asian either, and you can now go to Harvard even if you're an Asian. So let's not be fooled too much here. There is an opening of the system to voices of dissent, but it is an opening that could be just makeup. Because down the line, what he's saying when he says you don't have to apologize for being white anymore and you don't have to apologize for being Asian, he is making a case for a blind, racially blind meritocracy. But we are well beyond the racially blind meritocracy. Meritocracy has been destroyed by the leftists, and it's not coming back just because you wish it. The system has exposed itself to an extreme degree of tribalism. and to merely say by words, whites are welcome back, I think is not enough. And I think it's actually an attempt at the system to ingest some of the pro-white energy without truly giving whites what they deserve and what they want.
So he said, just so that I got this clear, he said, you don't have to apologize for being white anymore. And then he also said, and you don't have to apologize for being Asian or anything else anymore.
Yes, so, exactly.
Okay, right, okay. So he's saying the thing, but then qualifying it kind of so that it applies to everyone. So this isn't about being pro-white. For God's sake, don't think that. It's just we're not going to apologize for our immutable characteristics. I mean, obviously, he's married to a non-white woman, and there are photos of him with her family, and I think he was even wearing traditional Indian dress. He's coming from a certain perspective, but I get the feeling that he is pretty base, that he gets it, and that he probably became red-pilled after marrying her. I have no idea, but he does seem to be pretty on board.
Well, I don't know that he's based or whether he's just receiving good counseling, because at this point, you know that there are staff members who are capable of training a politician to say just the right thing, to be at this limit where they can be misheard as pro-white, but down the line, they don't have a pro-white project. We saw this with Trump. Trump was talking pro-white much more than he acted pro-white. And I'm afraid that we're in the replay here. And we have to be careful. We have to treat J.D. Vance with gloves and be careful, because there is a recruitment of pro-white discourse here at the service of an MLK-type racially blind discourse.
Yeah, and we've had enough of that over the last 60 years. Of course, the question is, why is that happening now? Because that is relevant to whether it will be accepted. And the reason it's happening now is that there is clearly, for the last 10 years, there has been a resurgence in white consciousness, white identity in America, especially among the young, especially among the men, for sure. I guess young white women are largely libtards still. But certainly the Zoomer generation. So they've felt that they had to respond to it. And so they're doing this and perhaps trying to cuck it, trying to dilute it. But I don't think that will work. I just don't think that. I mean, the game is not for them is not to trick white people, but at least permanently. It's just to keep them quiet, keep them satisfied, keep them fooled for long enough that they can be replaced. And so that it's just an absolute done deal. There's just absolutely no way for white people to rescue their situation, because of just mass immigration and race mixing and so forth. So do you think that is, I mean, I guess this gets to the biggest question of all, which is, what do you foresee for the future of America? Do you think it's going to balkanize with white areas and so on? Or do you think it is just going to end up like Brazil?
It is absolutely balkanizing already. I would say I was listening to The Woodlander today, and we are in a different situation in America because you guys are in very tight countries. And it's very hard to leave a country just legally and immigration-wise and money-wise. So you guys are in a situation where you're fighting for little plots of lands, and it is a significant action to have 60 acres, in Great Britain somewhere, and to be able to live there as whites and have an isolated community. In North America, the space is extremely available. And for example, me, I have come to live the dream of effectively living in a white ethno state without it being official and without solidarizing with people or donating money or pooling money the way Woodlander has to do it. Because in Canada, there is so much space toward the north that all you have to do is travel a little north. And you're going to be 1 hour away from a Walmart, but so be it. You're also going to be in a 100% white village. So the space changes the dynamics totally. Now, what you see in America is that the coastal areas are almost lost. They are lost to liberals or they are lost to immigrants. And I don't think this is going to be fixable. I think there is a withdrawal of white-only communities effectively existing mostly in the central part, which is in Canada, it's Alberta. Although Alberta also has its big cities, but you can live away from them and stay away both from the liberals and the immigrants. The equivalent exists in North Dakota, Montana, these central states that are often called the flyover states by the liberals, who just want to fly from one big city to another, and they don't realize that basically there is a movement of resistance of white people, and white Christianity is concentrating itself in those areas, and it leads to very viable areas. I don't have to care. I don't have to worry about criminality in a 2 hours radius from me, effectively. So that is absolutely feasible in America. So on the one side, I would say the fight for demographic control and democratic power is looking dark, in my view. But there is so much white pitting to be had in the resilience of life. White people are going to just be tough to make disappear, and it's not going to happen. They might lose control of certain areas, but the more they lose control, the more they will be pushed into white flight and into reconcentration. And down the line, I see it happening within the next few decades. There's going to be just a full acceptance by all whites. Okay, at this point, we are in these minority groups or quasi-minorities. And basically, the discourse that I could have as intellectuals this year or 10 years ago, they will have it. It will be a mainstream belief in the white resistance in 30, 40 years from now. And no one would think of thinking of the world in different terms, because they will all have come from people who had to reconcentrate, who had to flee areas. And I would say that those people who stay in the high diversity areas and high liberal areas, they will pay the price. They will pay the price of their daring of this, of losing power, of not controlling the place where you live, and ultimately of being faced with people who hate you. They hate you genetically almost. They hate you viscerally.
Well, this is the big irony. You know, that to be involved in this is to be called a hate monger. And yet what we're actually doing is protecting our own people from the hatred of other races. So you wouldn't say that there's going to be an immediate sort of political change then. It sounds like what you're talking about is in 30 years from now, where white people concentrating into certain areas. But right now, you seem to be saying that it's going to be more of the same.
There are lots of political victories to be had in the meantime, but those are not glorious political victories in which white majorities will simply just retake their countries. I can hope that this happens in certain European countries that are so cold that it will actually be easy to push back the migration waves. But I don't see, for example, America headed toward a resurgence of white political power. That being said, as white political power diminishes, it doesn't diminish that fast. And We will be on that slope for a very long time, and we will still be more than 50%. And even if we were 47 or 48% of the population, that is absolutely meaningful political power. It's just not total control. And so we have to play the game of politics to the extent that we can influence it and to the extent that we can slow down the attacks against us and make our lives more comfortable in the process. As you guys have described all day, from Greg Johnson to Jeff Deist, the technocracy is going strong, and it's we won't be able to overthrow the technocracy. The technocracy has its vicious ways, but our political power will matter, and we see that it matters simply in the fact that discourses that were radical 10 years ago are now in the mouth of J.D. Vance. That's a victory in and of itself, even if he's playing it. It means there's a game to be played. There's some leverage that we have. And someone like Nick Fuentes will play an extremely important role in the next 5 to 10 years to convert that leverage into actual victories. And those actual victories, we have to get out of our head that it is like recovering a 100% white nation. It's not this, but that doesn't mean there's nothing to be won. And there will be massive victories to be had in slowing down immigration process, in taming the technocracy, and caring for the continuity of our communities and our existence. And all of this will be played in the dirty game of politics rather than in a triumphant win.
So in retrospect, would you say that Charlie Kirk was a gatekeeper and that he was slowing things down, and with him gone, things are now accelerating? Or do you think this was happening even before?
Oh, that's definitely a true description. But there's so much about Charlie Kirk. It's actually a super complex phenomenon. Charlie Kirk was exactly what you just described. He was a cover on the kettle. He was keeping things from boiling above a certain degree. How he was accomplishing this, I didn't realize before he died. Charlie Kirk is one of these guys. It's actually a phenomenon where he was less important alive than dead. He actually marks American history and world history more now that he's dead than when he was alive, because when he was alive, it wouldn't have crossed my mind that the historical course of the U.S. was actually being tempered and slowed down and deadened by Charlie Kirk. He was relatively unimportant to me. But what he was doing, now we can see it now that he's dead. He was maintaining an illusion of that there is an actual society of debate and that the open society of liberalism still existed, because he was maintaining a cancel culture against the Nick Fuentes of this world, all of us, anyone far right. He was definitely putting a hard iron fist on maintaining cancel culture, and maintaining cancel culture, especially as it relates to anti-Zionist voices. And then he was engaging with liberals, and he was doing the Ben Shapiro kind of the skit of engaging with stupid people, with stupid ideas, and going for the low-hanging fruit. But in doing this, he was maintaining this false image of openness, this false image that we on the right were the ones who listen and want to engage with the opponent. Whereas, in fact, Charlie Kirk was basically hired by the elites of the U.S. to do exactly this, to misdirect the attention of people toward the wrong enemy. Because we can all agree that the LGBT ideologue is the enemy, but it's too easy of an enemy. And what we have to realize is that the true enemy of advancement is within the forces of the right. And that a J.D. Vance that would not be actually living up to his words that he says today, and or would actually slide like Trump did toward less pro-white as he gets into power, that would be more dramatic than even a leftist victory as for the presidency, because it would be a maintenance of exactly what Charlie Kirk was doing to society, which is maintaining the boiling point lower, making sure that time makes its effect. But time is against you when there's like hundreds of thousands and millions of people entering your country every year. It doesn't take much years for situations to become irreversible.
Well, yeah, indeed. What do you think of the idea that he was coming over to our side towards the end, in the last year of his life?
That is an open question. There's debate. The position of Nick Fuentes is that he wasn't. Of course, Nick Fuentes is crystallized into the view that Charlie Kirk was his enemy. And he's absolutely right historically in terms of the integral over time, the mass of time, the vast majority of Charlie Kirk's life was against Nick and therefore against the anti-Zionist voices and pro cancel culture. But he had sold his soul for this in a way. And I believe that Candace has a point when she says there was a genuine spiritual awakening. In other words, Charlie Kirk was getting close toward getting in the Tucker Carlson, Candace Owen current direction, where he would have, and he actually had given signs of this over years. So it's not like there's no record. He did describe the actions of Israel as a genocide, which was a no-no back in... He was the only mainstream right-wing voices, center-right voices, that would say these things. And at the very end, there we also have his Telegram discussion. Now, there's lots of interpretation, people saying, well, he didn't mean it, or it was kind of parody, or he was overstating it out of emotion. But he did say, leaving me no choice but to leave the Israel cause. He said these words days, or maybe one day or a few days before being shot. And that
I don't think those are ambiguous words. I think it's pretty clear. I don't think he was being funny. It's straightforward. Leaving me no choice but to leave the pro-Israel cause. I think those were the words. So I bring this up because I think it's important to remember him fairly. And I think my feeling is that he was coming around to our side. In another year or two, he would have basically been on our side, even if with some strings attached to some guilt or whatever. I think he was, there were things he said in the last, especially in the last few weeks of his life, about Irina Zarudska, for example, where it's clear he's talking in group terms about white people, white Americans are going to, I can't remember the exact thing he said, but it was something to the effect that we have, if there are going to be other groups seeing us as a group and attacking us as a group, we have to behave now as a group. It was something to that effect. I mean, how far is that away from any of us?
And he had said he was annoyed by the pressures. And this is a theme that's coming from Tucker, Candace, Megyn Kelly these days. He was very annoyed at the pressure. And he said that his Jewish donors were playing into all the stereotypes. Now, that's a very important sentence. He's basically saying, look, guys, the anti-Semites are describing you in a certain way. And you're behaving with me with this exact behavior that they criticize of you. This is effectively Charlie Kirk saying the anti-Semites, they kind of have a point, maybe. The fact that you could have a mainstream guy funded by millions of dollars of Jewish money stated, and the fact that he was killed right after saying these things is all extremely worrying. And if you want to know kind of where Charlie was headed, I think the best way to approach it is to use Tucker and Candace as his very close friends and see how Tucker and Candace have evolved over the last 1 year or two. He was probably headed there, and they're probably in a way trying to do what Charlie couldn't do. They're probably trying to give a life to Charlie in their current behavior. So if you want kind of a preview, you take a little bit of Tucker, a little bit of Candace, and dilute it by two, and you would get the current Charlie Kirk.
Yeah. So let's speak in more detail about what's the fallout from his killing, and that is obviously the mainstreaming of Nick Fuentes. And again, it was Tucker Carlson who probably took the first step there by interviewing him, and a fairly sympathetic interview. I mean, it wasn't a takedown job. It wasn't a hit piece. It was a fairly relaxed interview. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, what would you say about all of this and the consequences of mainstreaming Nick Fuentes?
This is very important because it puts Nick Fuentes into a position where he can further attack cancel culture and probably give a final blow to cancel culture. because we've always faced the problem that cancel culture has been associated with a leftist phenomenon. It's always the crazy SJW with blue hair. She's the one who wants to shut you down. But the reality is that the crazy blue hair feminist doesn't have much power. And she wasn't the one putting the off button on your YouTube channel. The fact is there were institutional forces that were actually centrist, kind of. They kind of sided with LGBT ideology and extremist far leftism, but they did so almost out of convenience. But the reality is these people are institutional, elite-driven people, the kind of people like Susan Wojcicki or like Joel Roth at X. These people were waging the actual power, and we are stuck with the fact that even if we put all of the woke away, there is still a force of censorship wanting to come at us from within the right. Now, Nick Fuentes, I guess, is kind of the nuclear option of Tucker Carlson in the face of this. And the reason why would Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, both invite Nick Fuentes all of a sudden? It's because they see that, there is currently a war for TPUSA. And they probably saw this before. This was probably all gamed before Charlie Kirk's assassination. So they see a TPUSA that is under pressure. They see it probably through their interpersonal friendship with Charlie Kirk. But ultimately, it's a war of civilization that's happening onto the shoulder of Charlie. It's the Jewish donors asking, we don't want you to go there. And it's Charlie Kirk feeling the youth. And Charlie Kirk was much closer to the youth, the next generation, and the leftists and the right-wingers of the next generation than his donors were. So he has this special angle where he says there is something irreconcilable between the top and the bottom. And Nick Fuentes kind of comes as a wild card in all this, willing to go on Piers Morgan and make these statements that even I, more extremist than Nick Fuentes, even I wouldn't go as far as he went on Piers Morgan, comments about the Holocaust that I couldn't even possibly even repeat. So that's interesting because it's an anti-up. I'm doubling down. I don't care about being offensive. We should not be. Certainly in America, we should not be feel bound not to talk about these things and even talk about these things in a comedic and parodic way. And that is where the Nick Fuentes kind of overdone, abusive kind of blatantness that he went with Piers Morgan changes the game. Because now you have a grounding for a force to show within TPUSA. And that's currently Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens from the outside. And we even had Stephen Bannon to say, hey, we won't let the institutional elite player and the Jewish billionaires take over this thing and basically make it into a leftist stand for leftist ideas within the right, which is what a Ben Shapiro wants to do. He wants to be the Jewish elbow within the right that basically will side with the left for reasons of social decency, taboos, Holocaust-related stuff. He has the same program as a leftist. He's just a socially conservative, family-oriented, heterosexual. That's what makes him a right-winger and kind of free economics. But that's it. Ben Shapiro, ultimately, does not belong in the true right. And it starts to show now. And it's beautiful that now you don't need to go on the Millennial or on the JFG Tonight show to hear that. You hear it from Steve Bannon that Ben Shapiro is a cancerous infection of TPUSA. And you hear it in less direct words, but very explicit still, by Tucker Carlson. So basically, Nick Fuentes is being used right now as a tool by Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, to elevate themselves into a credible kind of true alternative to Ben Shapiro. And in a way, they kind of need to be allied to Nick Fuentes, even if they will denunciate him and they will say when they're not interviewing him that he's an anti-Semite. Ultimately, they need that street cred that Fuentes is the only one to have developed. Because all these people, while Fuentes was developing his street cred, all these people were in the institutional game, serving the Fox News of this world.
Yeah, yeah. I think the great loser of 2025 is Ben Shapiro. I think he's had a truly abysmal year. And at the end of it, he seems a shadow of what he was a year ago. His reputation, his credibility have just been shredded. Let's make it explicit, though. What is it that Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon have against Ben Shapiro? Why do they think he doesn't belong on the right? Now, you and I know why. We have our own ideas, but I'm curious if you were to ask them, if you were to ask Steve Bannon, what would he say without giving an explicitly pro-white, like basically white nationalist answer?
This is what's fascinating. And such an important question and an important disbalance that you identify there. Because the fact is they don't really have a good, they don't really have a good answer to your question. I do. He's Jewish, and it's going to change his approach to everything right-wing. And he sees white people as a threat rather than as allies. So that's my problem that I would take. Now, they
and he's said that as well. He's basically said as much. He's constantly rallying against white identity, all the rest of it. So that's not some kind of, you know, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that JF just said. He said it in his own words. So, yeah, sorry.
So basically, Ben Shapiro has said, I'm okay with the browning of America. Well, okay, thanks for being honest about it. You know, but as far as I'm concerned, that makes you as much of an enemy as the blue-haired feminist who want white heterosexual men dead. But then Tucker Carlson, who refuses constantly to be identifying as white himself, and who even said things that are along the lines of, I don't care if America gets browned either. So if you don't care, just like Ben Shapiro doesn't care, then what is your problem? Now, Tucker Carlson, for now, is making a poor case around the values of American civilization. And you have to grant that he has some kind of a chair there to sit in, which is Ben Shapiro wants cancel culture. Ben Shapiro wants to treat the guy asking questions about the U.S. liberty as a Nazi. He wants Nick Fuentes canceled. Therefore, he is for cancel culture, and that's in violation to the American principle he's been brought up with. That is correct, but it's a small distinction. My wonder is, it does seem that Tucker has taken a full anti-Zionist, if not anti-Semitic, position on basically the umbrella of things, from positions on Israel, AIPAC, Jewish intervention in American politics, and now Ben Shapiro. What if Ben Shapiro was to say, all right, sorry about the cancel culture, I'm going to invite Nick Fuentes on my show. What if he does this? What does Tucker Carlson have left to oppose the Ben Shapiro of this world? And this is ultimately, these people are maintaining a cognitive dissonance because they're still refusing to identify as white. It would be as simple as this. If they could make that jump, the cognitive dissonance would be gone. But there's no good answer to your question because they live in that cognitive dissonance. Now, for Candace Owen, it's kind of a different approach because she's not white. She is black, and yet she is engaged in the same positioning as Tucker Carlson right now. And from her positioning, it does seem that she has taken a full anti-Semitic direction. I mean, she reads the Talmudic Jew, and she reads these books about the slave trade. And so she's taken her own black identitarian path in this. But she is increasingly also talking alliance between blacks and whites. She is saying blacks and whites are being made to fight against each other, when in fact it's an elite that leads to these fights and that wants these fights to happen. And I would grant her some degree of common understanding there. It's true that blacks and whites, if it wasn't of the technocratic institutional class, blacks and whites could very well share America in segregated neighborhoods, each living with their own, and in which the troubles of one neighborhood doesn't spit into another neighborhood. That would be a very desirable place to be, and we could be there if it wasn't of the liberal technocratic class that decided, no, we have to force them to integrate because we want to maximize black exposure to whites. And ultimately, you end up with the problem of entitlement to white prison.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what, not Bannon, but I think definitely what Tucker would say is Ben Shapiro doesn't belong on in the right, in the sense he doesn't belong in America first because he puts Israel first. Mm. I think that would be their... That would be their, at least their cover. But I mean, it's a legitimate case. It's a legitimate argument. Yeah. And I mean, Shapiro has even said he's on record saying that he stays in America because that's the best way that he can serve and protect Israel. So it's not actually America that he cares about. He's doing that so as to help Israel.
But so this is where I think Tucker is missing a foot into a solid principled view. Because then, okay, your only issue is an issue of policy with Ben Shapiro, where he's just an individual who just happens to love Israel, and you're just an individual who just happens not to think that you have tactical advantage continuing the alliance with Israel. But we all know this is not what's going on. And this is what's frustrating about the refusal of Tucker of his own racial consciousness. When he has a white wife, he has white babies, they're going to be treated differently because they're white in the future. And it's like, you just want to take Tucker and shake him out of his boomerism and say, no, no, the reason you find it annoying that Ben Shapiro wants to send some little small amounts of money to Israel, because down the line, we're really talking about small principled amounts of money. The reason it's annoying is that ultimately he's part of another group and he's within your country. And you are part of another group and you're not the same as him. And that's where it hurts. That's why it matters.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I don't know why he doesn't push that more. I mean, he has mentioned it. And I think their original, before Charlie Kirk got killed, they had a, I mean, this year really has been very eventful. There was they had a previous blow up at the previous Turning Point conference because Tucker Carlson was saying this stuff. And I think he also mentioned Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein being a Mossad operative at that conference as well in that same speech. Not sure now. But
yeah, he had said a statement that was basically pro-white and that got interpreted as white supremacist. And he kind of was loose about even defending it. And he was trying to explain it away and saying, oh, well, I didn't mean anything white supremacist by it. But you can see that basically the mainstream right is flirting with explicit pro-white discourse. And that's a big victory. It's to be celebrated. We will have leverage from it because we'll be able to demand things from an electoral program that eventually has consequences. But it's a small cultural victory. I would say, you know, in terms of cultural victory, we couldn't have done better. And 2025 is like the crowning of the normification of pro-white thought that is unabashed and unashamed. Like, I'm actually writing White People Food as a book, and I wonder if it will still be an edgy title in a year from now. I think there's going to be normie woman just buying my book for my bread recipes.
It could well be the case. I mean, they might think it's ironic, you know, like stuff white people like kind of thing, but why not? I do wonder. I mean, the thing is that the discourse seems to be changing so fast that nothing would surprise me now. And this is why I feel a lot of optimism in general about our cause, because I think that a stalemate has been broken that's lasted for a long time. And I think that people should take heart from that. I think that it's an exciting time. This year has been great for us in all sorts of ways.
I can feel the loosening because I'm back on YouTube, and I have a extreme anxiety that as a creator, every night I was finishing my show and I was refreshing my YouTube page to see if I had the yellow monetized button or the green monetized button. And now I'm releasing myself of this anxiety because every night it's green. I can talk about Nick Fuentes. I can talk about the provocative stuff he said on Piers Morgan. I'm still monetized. So something has been released in the elites, and they've kind of understood that they were boiling the frog too quick on white people and on cancel culture.
That's definitely happened in North America. I've seen other. I can't remember if any big American or Canadian channels have been banned over the last 2 years. I don't think so. None that come to mind. But Britain is different. Zoomer Historian just got banned. Numerous people recently have applied to get their channels back. It hasn't worked. So I think the British government might be involved there, and I think they might have said to YouTube, just keep these people off. I mean, who knows? You can be too conspiratorial. It might be that YouTube's own staff, like their department in Britain, is making those decisions, and it is off a different mind than the American one.
Actually, your first reading is correct. We've seen it. It's now compartmentalized. The Australian government gets their Australian citizen banned. The Great Britain does their own people. And so for people in Canada, I guess I'm just lucky in a way. Somehow the Canadian government decided to put the brake pedal on this. Like, why would you fight your own citizens? Ultimately, there's a community of international speech, and you can be part of it as an exporter country, or you can't. Now, if Canada comes and asks YouTube to ban me, they're depriving themselves of income, because who's paying my super chats? Well, it's people from around the world, and I'm enriching Canadian economy with it. So I think that in the US and Canada, there was just a break of government communication with YouTube, but there's these other regional places where they still do it. And YouTube basically will apply a regionalized consideration of whoever is the current government. That's too bad if you end up on a bad jurisdiction. But long term, I think that's good, because it means everything has been fragmented. There's no more a common institutional control of all speech. And eventually we can fight for those countries where it's still happening.
All right. It's been a long story about censorship. And as you say, I agree that it seems to be on the wane in North America. But Britain and other European countries as well, basically all of them, seem to be, if anything, doubling down on this with actual law. And it's scary. It's a scary time. There was one other thing that you said in your notes, which was, will white positive people have to find a home on the left? That's sort of out of left field. What's your rationale there?
Well, my rationale is that we are faced with the J.D. Vance discourse. And it's very clear that there's a bait and switch in the preparation here. J.D. Vance is saying, yeah, white people. Now he starts with white people. Now, the classical way to approach race-blind discourse was to basically leave white people aside. This is what Trump has done. So Trump is always against racism, against black people, and will call it out. But if there's something anti-white happening, he's never going to say white. He's always going to say Christian, or, oh, well, there was kind of an inverted racism here happening. But he's never going to say white. Now, J.D. Vance is playing a bait and switch here, and it looks like it's the same. But now he's using the term white. But now he's integrating the term white with a continuation sentence in which he says, oh, yeah, and Asians, too, they can do whatever they want. we have to develop a leverage technique. This is a case that's been made by Nick Fuentes for many years. We need to have political leverage to say to these people, that's not enough. It's not enough to just say, oh yeah, everyone can be any color they want. Because that's bringing us back to MLK-style liberal philosophy. And with that kind of philosophy, there's nothing wrong about infinite immigration. Because that's just an infinity of more people to have more fun in our race-blind country. We have to face the problem that only white people are being called to race blindness, and only white people actually care about being fair enough and non-judgmental enough that they would even listen to calls for race blindness. Because if you have a bunch of black people or even a bunch of women who take over a department of hiring at some local hospital, they will always hire their own. You have an Indian doctor, he will always hire an Indian secretary. They will always favor themselves. And because of this, race blindness is merely a white handicap. Now, if we don't have political power, all we can do is just hope that the cultural victories keep scoring within the elite. But something tells me that there's no reason it would. There's no reason J.D. Vance would not be only by speech and by appearance joining pro-white discourse. But the case of Nick Fuentes has been forever. You guys have to be ready to follow me into basically supporting a Kamala Harris, into threatening the Republican Party that we will desire a defeat if you don't give us something more than words. And I believe that this may develop very well. If I had a prediction for the evolution of the left in the next 5 to 10 years, I predict a return of a Bill Clinton type of presidency, and even one that would actually be explicitly pro-white working class. Because there is this whole segment of the population that truly is not truly ideologically right-wing. They just want America to work, and they want work for themselves, and they know that their children is working class, and they're white. And they're not willing to commit to even right-wing economics or to commit to right-wing pro-race, explicitly pro-whiteness. But they just want America to work, and they have these worries in the background of their mind. And that would be extremely well-served for the Democrat Party to say we're going to tap into that voting base. Because the immigrants, we have them already. They're always going to vote Democrat. They've been selected part of a system of institutional control. They're more likely to come from universities. They're just more likely to be within that liberal mindset. And they're always going to be trapped for the Democrat. So we may see 2026 and 2028 as perhaps it's time to make ourselves lose. And perhaps it's time to say, you know what? The working of America and the preservation of certain important ways of life of America, and perhaps even a hope on demographics, would be better served by a loss for these exploiters like J.D. Vance, who just know how to use the language to fool you into voting them. That's what I trend toward. Now, if the left is intelligent enough to do that reading too, then we should expect the left to be veering pro-white even harder than J.D. Vance. Now, that's interesting because that gives us bilateral leverage. And if we can have the Republican Party scared enough that they would not have enough of the white vote to pass 2028 and to get a J.D. Vance in, then we will start having what every community has already, except white, which is capacity for bilateral negotiation. The blacks have always been trying to tempt the Republican Party. And at some point, George Bush even gave black people houses. And Barack Obama gave black people cell phones. They became the Obama phone. We have to be able to get our Obama phones as white people. And we may very well be able to do this between 26 and 28 if we can scare both sides that they're not good enough to win without us.
Yeah, because I mean, white people are still a majority of the voters in America. So they, as far as I know, they're certainly a huge bloc anyway. So they need to start acting as a bloc, really. That's, yeah. I think that's the point either way, because then they can be the kingmaker. They can choose who is going to win. Both parties need to feel that that's a possibility, that they could get the white vote. And therefore, both parties need to be aware of it'd be terrible for them if they didn't. It's a matter of white people, as usual. It's the same old issue, really. Will white people collectivize in their own interests or not? Because that's always been the problem, that you've had two sides and white people are played off against these two sides and end up never getting what's good for them, never getting what they want. So you would hope that they'll wise up and grow out of that and actually start taking control of the game, because they could, if they wanted to, if there
There's
was enough
no
intelligence.
There's no better force in politics. So if any group has power in politics, it is white. They've been brainwashed, but the brainwashing is currently washing away. And when you see Candace Owens at the top of the streaming world right now, this has massive significance, and the future looks pretty good in terms of what we'll be able to accomplish, and in terms of retaking control of our nation, because the top of the streaming world, to have someone who basically understands that we've been lied to, and that the entire current system of media, even including social media, as it was controlled by the same elite, it's very white pilling. And we can talk about Candace Owens. I mean, she's a special case, and she's bringing streaming in an interesting special direction with massive risk. She's being mocked. She's being debunked. It is the rise of, we are in the post-factual world. The left basically set that up, that basically the public space is no more a place of agreement. It's more like, which bubble are you coming from, and which spammer X account did you end up believing on, this one or that one? And Candace is just seeding lots of uncertainty into our public process with these Egyptian plane, who killed Charlie Kirk, theories and conspiracies. It's an entirely new type of streaming. But ultimately, I think it's good. I think we have finally a public epistemology of, we're going to have someone aggressively pursue cases, aggressively pursue the epistemology of, yeah, did something happen with these Egyptian planes? Let's ask the question and let's look into it. The problem being that the institutions never were capable of delivering transparency on this. The institutions always came to us with the final story, and you kind of had to believe it because they would give you nothing else, and they would redact anything uncomfortable about it. Now we have Candace Owens taking steps that she may lose massive amounts of credibility down the line. She's taking huge risks. Like, I personally, I don't know if Brigitte Macron is a man. I have no clue. And I've listened to every documentary about it. I've read everything they wrote about it. I still don't know whether she has a penis. But that is the fantastic place we are in, where the future is not set. It's like in Terminator 2, Sarah Connor. The future is not set. There's no fate but what we make. Finally, we are at a place where the elites are trembling. They are visibly trembling. When they send Ben Shapiro at PPUSA, and when Ben Shapiro has to buy his way into the right-wing movement with $1 million donation straight after Charlie Kirk's death, kind of saying, I own you, Erica. You know, don't let me go away. There's lots of money coming from my way. The elites are trembling. The fact that they have to be so desperate that you pay $1 million and yet you get mocked by four different speakers in a row. Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly dunking on you, and then Stephen Bannon saying you're cancer. That is a beautiful thing of 2025. And going into 2026, that makes me say anything can happen. Finally.
I'll have to watch those speeches. I haven't had time to watch anything because of Millennial. All right, so we'll get to some super chats now. Regarding food, the Wanderer asked, has JF ever tried a pasty? These are the Cornish pasties, mostly. Yes. I'm curious whether he may have...
Oh, go ahead.
I'm curious whether he may have come across a Breton variant somewhere in Quebec.
No, I have had access because I traveled to Edmonton. I now live in Alberta. I have found absolute liberty in the northern area, in the northern area of Alberta. And I drove to Edmonton, where there is a genuine Scottish charcuterie. They prepare actual haggis from sheep's stomach. They prepare Cornish pastries. They prepare all delicious sausages and, of course, black pudding. So I've had the taste of genuine Scots-prepared versions of all these meats. And I've discovered haggis from this charcuterie just 3 months ago. And it's one of the discoveries of my life. Absolutely delicious.
That reminds me of a joke I once heard. Did you hear about the white nationalist group from Cornwall, the Cornish pasties? All right, friend of Gandalf, a question for Woz: what made you initially decide to include JF in your millennial rotation? His takedown of Kraut and Tea. Well. The first time JF was on Millennial was 2017, which was immediately after that whole thing. So I think that would have been involved, but I think that I would have invited him on anyway, regardless of that nonsense with Kraut and Tea, because he was relevant. He had become relevant to the scene in that year. Had you started your channel in 2016?
My channel was definitely started. But I was converting from mostly scientific content to right-wing, pro-white content. Have I been on the Millennial 1 year before the Kraut and Tea stuff, or was it really my first year? In any case, this led to a meteoric rise of my popularity, and it was a big moment. It was a big moment for the alt-right in general. That was just an explosive moment.
Oh, do you mean the Kraut and Tea?
Well, debacle? The Kraut and Tea and everything, really. This kind of window of time was spectacular.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was great. Very exciting. So that's why I first invited him on. Okay, Jack Dobson. I always enjoy JF, and I hope he includes Southern United States food in his book. I expect Charlie Kirk has made a calculated business decision to move away from Uber Zionism because his audience was going in that direction. He previously did this with his position on immigration. Yeah, probably. He was probably led by his followers to a great extent. But we know that there was stuff going on behind the scenes with his donors and whatever, and pressure being put on him by Netanyahu and Josh Hammer and others. So I don't think it was just his followers. I don't think he was just I think it was various things, multiple things.
Absolutely. Very correct reading. Now, as far as the Southern food from America, look at what I had. I was doing a photo up for my book, and this is genuine Southern chicken. This is a whole chicken with breast, thigh, drumsticks, with genuine buttermilk, breading, pickles, and biscuits. Genuine buttermilk biscuits from the South of America. So definitely Southern American cuisine is a big feature in the book.
Excellent. There was a question that I asked. What's JF's favorite happening from 2025, and how does he see this carrying through to 2026? I think we've talked about that, but is there anything else that you'd want to say about 2025?
I mean, I don't want to say the assassination of Charlie Kirk is my favorite happening, because of course I'm sad about it. The sadness at the human level is massive, but all of the stemming consequences and the phenomenon that we could call the end of gatekeeping, that is what marks 2025 in my view. The end of gatekeeping is going to be even bigger next year, and this is a snowball that can't be stopped.
Yeah, and another aspect of that is, which has also happened this year, is non-white people being suddenly being masked off about their anti-whiteism, and actually of all people, Dinesh D'Souza, twice, not just once, but twice, he was gloating about the success of his ethnic group in America,
and Vivek,
and then there was that guy about 2 weeks ago, some Pakistani guy in America who'd his parents were fraudsters of some kind, and he was gloating that, well, you let us in, and we have lots of kids, so we're going to take over.
Oh yeah,
I mean, it becomes ever harder for the civic nationalist cuck or even the progressive moron to keep telling themselves that this is all going to be okay, because the non-whites are telling you it's not going to be okay for you, for you white bastards. You know, we're taking over your country. So it's obvious that there is at least some degree of malice and triumphalism in this for them. So I'm glad
whites that are staying in this environment, and they've kind of learned to accept it as part and parcel of their life. Like they think that it's normal to get your car stolen. No, you should be in a society where you can't possibly have your car taken from you. You should live in a society where it's impossible that someone broke your windows. It's as simple as this. Well, when you live in a white area, that won't happen.
Well, they think it's perfectly normal to have your country stolen from you.
Yeah,
that's really it. That this is just, well, people have always migrated, and so there's nothing, there's nothing unusual about this massive demographic change. Well, yeah, there is, and you should be alarmed about it, and it's not going to be pleasant. So you should be fucking angry about it. Yeah. All right. So yeah, I'm glad that they're being open and upfront about it now, because I think that's great. It really simplifies and clarifies things for white people. So I think that's a great step forward, which I don't really know why that happened. I think it was partly because Indians just can't stop themselves. They just can't stop themselves from being obnoxious and
rude
to white people.
It was actually a 4chan Indian guy who actually expressed that they have a word in Indian culture for this. And I don't remember the exact word, but it's something like misplaced pride or something like this, where they actually they're proud when they fuck you. They're proud when they mess with you, and they're even proud when they step over their own principles, which they don't have in the end. That's what he was explaining.
Yeah, the word was izzat.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Izzat.
Here it is. And yeah, people can look that up in their own time. I've got the full thing, but I'm not going to put it on screen. So yeah, it was interesting about their mentality, about their culture, and you know, people will see shadows of it in the West today because of the mass presence of these people. So yeah, I'm glad that this is all out in the open now. I think that's really great. All right, let me see where we were. Okay, as a disembodied voice, JF, I will be asleep when this is read, but will you include liqueurs in your upcoming book, White People Food? I am obsessed with Cointreau, and I think I thank your French ancestors for creating it.
I will take note of this. I want to cover all food phenomenon, from fast food to convenience store food. I even have the barbecue McRib sandwich. So I will include some liqueur for you. Absolutely. I've added it to my list.
Okay. All right. And he also says, you should ask Woz about Scottish and British food. He may have some other knowledge. Ask him about roll and square sausage with mustard and onion. It's a Scottish classic. Well, honestly, I didn't know about that.
Roll and square sausage.
Yeah, I've never heard of that, I'm afraid. That's terrible. You two are born in the early mid-80s. Your cohort are now taking on elder statesman status in our little movement. Do you feel ready for this? Do you feel old? Are you ready to be a wise guide? Yes, I think so. I mean, I certainly won't claim to have the answer to everything, but I can certainly advise people on things. So I'm not intimidated by that status. It's not like I feel I'm not ready for it, no.
Yeah, in a way, we faced more difficulties than we should have. And the betrayal of our generation is something that we'll have to find a name for. Because when they came in with DEI and stuff, you might think, oh, it has hurt white people in general. But the reality is it hasn't hurt boomers that already had their jobs. And there will be a generation in the future that will not be hurt by it because we'll have abandoned DEI by then. So ultimately, it's the people like me who have worked their ass off to postdoc level, becoming a specialist in my domain. I arrive on the job market and they decided we are only hiring brown people. So the white people of a very specific window of ages were actually targeted by DEI. And that was a massive betrayal from previous generations, boomers and alike, basically allying with the liberals and the immigrants to say we will basically reimburse you for years of oppression according to liberal doctrine, but we'll do it with a single generation of punished white people. And so, yeah, when we get hold, me and Millennial Woes, we will have gone toward the true injustices that no one will ever have to go through ever again. But somehow we had to make that sacrifice, and I think that will make us wise men who will be good counsel for people rising in the new world, which you guys have been describing, this technocracy that finds them useless.
Yeah, and I'll be open about this. I was insulated from that kind of thing because I wasn't in the job market at that time. However, I've certainly got a lot of experience of being in this movement and the deplatforming, the infighting, the backbiting, you know, all of that kind of stuff that goes on. So I could certainly advise people on how to deal with that kind of fucking nonsense. I think as you get older, you gather wisdom. It's a natural process. But I'm certainly not arrogant about it. I would just offer my advice, but I'm not going to say I can solve situations. Ultimately, everyone has to do that themselves. The Wanderer also said it's crazy how Ben Shapiro in the States and Lord Finkelstein in Britain are representatives of conservatism.
So
absolutely.
I know from an American perspective, everyone is laughing at Finkelstein and memes are rising. How did you receive it from an English perspective?
Well, again, this happened at the start of Millennial, so I didn't really, I was busy with that. I didn't see much of it, but I see it on Twitter and he's a laughing stock.
Yeah.
I'm certain that the mainstream media, I don't have a TV, haven't had one for many years now, but I'm certain that the mainstream media will be taking his side. But I'm also certain that that will really not matter much because the mainstream media doesn't matter much anymore. Mm. So I can't tell you. I can only guess. But on Twitter, he's just a complete lol cow. I think he's handled it very badly. But I can also, there's a certain amount of sympathy that I feel for him because I think at his age, I don't know how old he is. I guess I could find out quite easily. Hold on. He's 63, and I actually saw him on the tube once on the sub of the London Underground. It was quite funny, but anyway, at his age, he's suddenly been thrust into this completely new environment for him, and I think he's hoping, surely, that these old taboos will still work, and that will shut them up, and that will shame them, and it's just not working. And but he, I mean, I don't, I'm not a fan of the guy, and he's clearly been I mean, it's disingenuous. And, you know, you and his arguments on Twitter with Connor Tomlinson are very instructive. They're actually really good threads to read. The guy is, it's a joke. He's just made a complete arse of himself. So that's what I would say about that.
Kind of an artifact from a different world that we can see from a museum.
Exactly. But it's not like he's ancient. He's only 63.
But I think I'll be younger at 63 than he is.
Yeah. But yeah, he just can't handle it. He just can't handle it. But then neither can Piers Morgan. He's made a complete fool of himself.
Which brings
as well.
Us to something important. Boomerism is a state of mind. And we even have Brian Holihan, the rising replacement to Charlie Kirk, who's a boomer of his own generation. So boomerism is truly not a generation, it's a mindset.
I always remember you had a commenter called, and I loved this username, I thought it was so funny, Tactical Boomerism.
Yes.
I always thought that was such a funny name. Anyway, all right, Pleb Lordy. Is there scope for ethno-Europeans to accept Zionist influence or funds to resist Islam, etc., but when push comes to shove, ignore or turn against the Zios when they want a quid pro quo? I don't really think so, because they tend to get real control over an organization. The only one that I see as an exception to that is the AFD, because the Germans are so autistic that I think they're almost, I can imagine it, like the Zionists will think they've got control of it, but the Germans will just be oblivious and just power on ahead with their ideology and take it farther and farther. That's what I could see happening there. But generally the answer is no. I think it's a bad idea to take that funding, because it as we've seen time and time again, that it subverts your organization, and that's the point of it. That's the only point of it.
Generally, it will handcuff you. I will say, though, there are certain ninjas that can have a one-shot betrayal towards Zionists. Like the way I took money from Jeff Epstein, that's something you can pull once in your life. But then once they detect you as an outside and opposing force, they won't give you money anymore. So be sure you do it quick and ninja-like.
And read the small print.
Yes.
All right. Okay, and Stephen said, in my opinion, one thing we need to get past is the idea that politicians need be genuinely our guys. As long as we can guide key people to the right talking points, then that will increase public rightward drift, which in turn will trap politicians in our favor.
That's very intelligent.
Yeah, that's quite a pragmatic approach. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to read it again. One thing we need to get past is the idea that politicians need to be genuinely our guys. As long as we can guide key people to the right talking points, then that will increase the public's rightward drift, which in turn will trap politicians in our favor. That's, very good. Yeah, I don't have any criticism to make of that or disagreement.
Yeah, I would say keep in mind that the world is going right-wing direction naturally. It's like liberals don't reproduce to begin with. So it's inevitably time long-term is on our side. And yes, instead of just playing the politics game in terms of trying too hard to convince liberal politicians of something, you might want to just concentrate on cultural victories and make the flow of society just had the way the alt-right did for the last 10 years. And you could say it's a model of cultural change that was successful.
Yes, actually. And that's always been my idea. You know, just keep pushing in our direction and in the right direction, and things will gradually fall into place. And that's exactly what's happened. So, no, we never needed this Spergy purity spiraling. It never helped us in the end, I don't think, anyway. But then again, that kind of contradicts what I just said about the AFD, but that's for another time. All right. The point is that in terms of public relations, yeah, it's important to seem reasonable and sane. The worst thing you can seem is like some you know, that you're being unreasonable, because the public are just, they're allergic to that, even in the most dire circumstances.
Yeah.
All right. Angerad Celtic says, JF, you must include champagne.
Absolutely. I have it in sauces. I have biscuit rose from France. So champagne will have a place in the book.
Okay. And friend of Gandalf says, an unspoken but profound reason that white men tolerate their situation is that a diverse society makes each white man the highest status person in every room he enters, at work, at social events, etc. Flattery and attention are hard to give up, even if it comes with a side serving of eventual extinction. That's an interesting point that I don't think I've ever heard made before.
Is he saying that in the leftist order we're kind of elevated to the white man, the threat in the room? Is he talking about this?
No. He means that we're the highest status, because, I mean, I can remember a long time ago, about 2005, I think it was, I was at this job at this call center, and all the other guys there were Indians. And I eventually realized that they really looked up to me, and I couldn't understand. Like, there was a sort of slavishness towards me, which okay. I didn't sort of seek out, and I didn't really like it, frankly. But I couldn't understand it, and I think that's what he's alluding to, that the fewer white people there are, because of all the non-whites, the more those white people become. If you're the only white guy in the room, then you're the guy that all the Indian women in the room want to sleep with, because you're the white guy. That sort of thing. So it's an interesting point. But the problem is that we're talking the eventual extinction is sort of important. So, but yeah, he's not saying that. What he's saying is just noting this, that a lot of white people will, especially white men, okay. will enjoy that. And of course, white women, white women especially will enjoy this, because if you're the only white woman in the room and all these Indian guys and black guys, they all will want to sleep with you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it does actually temporarily elevate the status of white people. It's an interesting one. I can't believe I've never seen that before. So thank you for making that point, friend of Gandalf. All right. Well, let's end this one here then. I think that's everything. So just remind people about your work and the upcoming book and anything else that you want to tell people.
You can find me on YouTube at JFG Tonight, and my upcoming book will be Before Next Christmas, White People Food. I want to set a standard of recording and archiving the state of food in the entire white world, from America, Canada to Russia, passing through Sweden and everything in between. Thank you so much for having me, Millennial Rose, and thanks to the people who have sent super chats. I highly support the millennial as one of the most important true internet traditions.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, yeah, thanks everyone who has donated and watched tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow night, and I think tomorrow night might be there are going to be 5 interviews tomorrow, because just scheduling conflicts. So I've got to squeeze the Jolly Heretic in at the start. So we're starting 1 hour early. The Jolly Heretic, then Stefan Korte, then Paul Weston, then Prosopa Insights, and then finally the Distributist. So that's going to be quite a long night, but it should be interesting. So, all right. I'll see you all then. In the meantime, JF, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.